Well, thank you, Teresa. I don't know whether I should be depressed or annoyed after all these things. So I'll depress you just a little bit more, because I did work on the PowerPoint, Armin, and I'm an academic, so I'm going to use them. As I talk and as the others talk, and we give this conceptual framework for this big, audacious idea that we have, which we think is very workable, just keep in mind, don't just stand there, do something. We were here last year, we spoke about stress in the military, came right after the Fort Hood tragedies, and tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. But the tragedies continue. There's nothing being done. So I think this is our effort to try and propose, let's do something. And hopefully it's a good thing. Oh, yes, I am. Also, I have my disclosure statement, which APHA likes to promote or have us make, and then the disclaimer that the university wants me to make. But I assure you, even though the opinions I expressed during the presentation are not necessarily those of the university, if I say anything wonderful or if anything is patentable, they will become their property. I assure you. Just want to say that for the dean. Go quickly through the first set of slides. These are statistics that I think some of my other colleagues have more than adequately regaled us with, some very, very bad information about what's going on, some very good information about bad things that are going on out there. But I did want to note, and the highlight is, much of what we see, particularly with the issues that we see in the military and suicide, I think that a lot of it is preventable. And I hope it's preventable. Otherwise, we're in dire straits, and our young women and men and their families are in dire straits. Riskier lifestyles, I don't think this is any surprise. I am constantly stunned by the rates of suicide in the overall population, whether you're young, old, or middle-aged. The suicide rates are just horrific. And when you look at the sweet spot, if there is one, for suicide rates, it pretty much correlates pretty well to junior enlisted ranks of the E1 to the E4s. And I am a father of a Marine Corps sergeant, so I pay particular attention to all of these statistics. Talking a little bit about gender and identity, I don't think any of this is rocket science. I'm not a sociologist by training, but I do think it's important for me to highlight something that Armin spoke about and others spoke about the concerns and what happens in Marine Corps and any of the services, I should say. The military view of gender identity is specialized, and it has its own social construct. It's very difficult to change that social construct. So while I hear people talking a lot about the concerns that military personnel and their families have about talking about stress and mental health issues because it might affect their career, I think it's even more profound than that. And it's a realization I came to while hearing all of you speak. I think it is a social construct. So I wrote the words before I heard you speak, but I think it's even more profound than that. I think that it is an entire social construct that leads these folks to go into service, and it is reinforced because of the missions of the services. They're acculturated. This is the general language and rhetoric that we hear thrown at men, and since I in part represent the Men's Health Network, I'll focus on the guys, but certainly for women in military, I think there's parallel constructs. Suck it up, take it like a man. What a great athlete. He's playing with a broken, name your appendage. Workplace images. It's not just in the Marine Corps or in the military service. You have executives in large corporations who will not say, I have a physician's appointment. I have to go to the doctor's office. I'm feeling a little blue today. You don't hear that kind of conversation at the water cooler. When you look at what goes on in the military training and the toughness, the readiness, the reliability that has to be there, there is an entire new social context laid upon individuals who are very positively predisposed to be tough-minded. There was an interesting study, and then I'll get onto the de-stress zone concept, that was done amongst family physicians about why men don't seek health and health care. And when you look at some of the reasons that men say are barriers to seeking health care, need to conceal their vulnerability, need to appear and feel independent, lack of time and support by their employer. Now, take this in a general context, and then pump it up a bit and make the Uber arguments for those in the military, not susceptible to health concerns. They're invincible. It's the invincible team syndrome that plays out for a long time. Lack of credibility of health providers. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but I think that there is a perception there that health providers don't understand what I'm going through. Knowledge deficits and inaccuracies. So if you take all of these things, If you take all of these things, why are we surprised that members of the military are at very high risk for potential health-related issues, including depression and mental health issues? I will, here are some more staggering strategic and depressing statistics. I think that we all appreciate. Armand mentioned these a little bit, but I was able to find an article in USA Today yesterday, I believe, that alluded to the fact that the problem is getting worse, and we look at the suicide rates across the services. It's very, very high for those branches where they're active duty and the branches where they're not really heavily engaged in the current war efforts. It's not good by any chance, but it's certainly a distinct difference. So it's just not getting better. And the military is trying, but I think they too, the military leadership, has their own social constructs that are impediments for them to doing certain things. So we're proposing something from the private sector to help. The impact on families, Armand mentioned this as well, 18% greater potential for behavioral health problems of 3 to 8 year old children of deployed service members, 19% greater problems for stress disorders in these individuals. Also, the number of overall physician visits during deployment have decreased by 11%. This is a study that was recently published in Pediatrics just this week, I believe. So the number of, or the percentage of individuals in this 3 to 8 year old range is probably even understated because the physician visits are down. Perspective, there was an NPR story that came out recently. Nearly as many American troops at home and abroad have committed suicide this year as have been killed in combat in Afghanistan. I am unbelievably astounded that the op-ed piece that was referred to earlier by Ms. McCabe didn't get picked up. Maybe this is a good time to resurrect that. Maybe there are some people paying attention to the tragedies that are happening and the disproportionate numbers. Again, something that Armand so wisely spoke about and so eloquently and so passionately spoke about, and there is an impact on the families. And I suppose that if the wife is the deployed military member, these kinds of issues of depression, anxiety, sleeplessness, and mental health conditions transfer to the fathers. To have the military to abruptly dramatically changed its institutionalized views about toughness is just not going to happen, if it happens at all. And maybe we shouldn't ask that of the military. Maybe their mission, their principal mission, is to create tough individuals, but maybe there is a way that the private sector can also be of help. So here's our proposal. Hold on to your socks. The de-stress zone. You got to keep it simple and give it a catchy name. Spent a lot of time giving a lot of things catchy names when I was at Pfizer. The objective is to provide military personnel and their families access to effective approaches to mitigate mental health stress of deployment and hostile zone duty. Our strategy is to provide a network of off-base and non-military affiliated community centers for military personnel and their families in the pre, peri, and post-deployment phase. So again, looking at the entire spectrum, because it is a continuum, and if it's as with many interventions in mental health, if you intervene early on, you've got a better chance of mitigating problems later on. So we think it's important to do it this way. What we're proposing is to partner with outside existing community-based organizations, which have a core service component, such as the YMCA, develop training and resources for specialized counseling and triage services within these centers to serve as first-line review and referral for the family member or the military personnel. We think that that is something that can be done in some of the programs that you were talking about in the early detection. I worked on a program with Pfizer called PrimeMD where we developed very simple to use screening tools and training individuals who are social work trained or community trained to serve this function, I think is a useful way to do it. provided needed fundamental services for those individuals, such as recreation, childcare, and events, pre-deployment. Just having someone watch your kid for a couple of hours is a wonderful blessing. Sometimes that's all that they need, is that time to reconnect just before deployment. Some of these centers have those kinds of capacities and they're there. Maintain a sense of connectedness to the civilian world. So totally important when we heard Armin speak so eloquently about the issues that these women and men face, and have them connect to the community during their deployment process and when they come back in. So yes, they're leaving for a year, but the separation is within the community, and the community embraces them. Yes, the military family embraces them, but this is a shot at trying to get the community to embrace them. Provide a camouflage, is a military acronym, a safe harbor within the community to confidentially access counseling, screening, and referral services. I hear from so many military and other individuals who work with military that the problem isn't that they don't have those services, but even just walking into the counseling center is tough to do. Telling your master sergeant or your gunny sergeant, listen, I'm feeling a little blue today. I think I'm going to take a walk over to the health center. My gosh, you know, my son had pneumonia. They said, look, you want to get your medicine, go walk about 2 miles down to the dispensary and go get it in the rain. So there are insurmountable, I believe, cultural problems, and we can't wait. So providing this camouflage, a community center where it's a natural place to go, where you can work out and then meet with a counseling representative or a triage representative in a safe harbor, I think, is fundamental to the logistics of the plan. So that's, in a nutshell, what we're proposing. It's been well received by individuals and organizations that we've had some preliminary discussions with. We want to get your feedback as well when Scott comes back up. Here's the implementation phase. We're looking to do at least a pilot project. We certainly have to show proof of concept. We want to try and get it off next year. We'll see. If you don't try, start somewhere, you're not going to get anywhere. Men Health Network will establish and create the coalition and serve as a coordinating base and bring in lots of additional parties, and have a list of individuals we think might be helpful. We want to look at 3 sites within the United States, obviously areas where there's large deployment movements in and out, and there is an established ready partnership with a community center that fulfills the requirements that we're proposing. Train community-based counselors. I think that there's money in the Healthcare Reform Act, and there might be some money in the Department of Defense to actually find some individuals who would serve as these counselors. They'd be in the community, they'd be in the centers, and I think that that's perfectly doable. Early assessment of outplaced transition impact. We want, of course, whatever you do, you have to show that it works. Try and do that in first quarter 2012, and then a full assessment of the pilot project in the fourth quarter 2012. Very aggressive, but as I said, let's start someplace. Expertise and working partnerships. Men's Health Network has spoken with a lot of folks, but certainly I don't have all that expertise. My good colleagues at Men's Health Network don't either. We all have fire in our bellies to get it done. So if we bring something to the table, it's that, and a personal commitment to try and make it work. Who might we partner with? This is kind of a laundry list of who might be helpful. If anybody in the audience represents any of these groups and you are interested, we certainly would love to talk with you at some point, give you some contact information. And then funding, yeah, nothing happens without a few bucks. I think the pilot, who knows how much it really will cost, but our guesstimate is that for a three center pilot with the attendant materials that then could live on afterwards, and then the assessment and the evaluation, and then building the network would be about 1.2 to 1.5 million for that 2 to 2.5 year period. We've had some good progress to date. Scott's mentioned some of that. Now we need to move forward. We've spoken with several stakeholder groups and allies are in conceptual agreement. We're looking for agreement on key community-based network organization to house the project. We have not started that yet, but we're hoping to start that soon. And then identify commission programs and planning committee members. We need people to help us put it all together, to lend their name, their expertise, their offices, their organizations to making this all happen. Identify solid and solidify funding sources. We need people with expertise to do that. I'm not a grant writer. I don't know if any of the people in Men's Health Network are grant writers, and we're not grant writers in this particular domain. So we need that, and we need grant review expertise as well. And create an expert working group, for each of these areas. I think we need some individuals with appropriate credentials to oversee and to guide and to help us assess. And yes, to talk it up. Potential funding sources. Well, I think there are a lot of people, despite the fact that the media wouldn't pick up on this op-ed piece, I think there are a lot of people who have a warm heart in this, a warm spot in their heart and a warm spot in their wallets for these kinds of issues. We just need to, as you might say, flesh them out and then get them to commit some amount of dollars. But certainly there's going to be some hard work. We have to apply for monies. I think there's grant monies, members of Congress. There are lots of ways, I think, that this, relatively speaking, small amount of money can be garnered to make this project happen. If you have a checkbook with $1.5 million in it that's not committed, come on up, write us, email us. Armin said I have to make the ask, so of course I'll do that. If you don't and you just want to help and you have ideas or you'd like to serve, please also contact us. That's the project. Please help us to help those who keep us safe. And that's...
You're absolutely correct. It's not just buy-in from the military involved in health, providing health, but also public health officials, and then also very much the community that we would be doing these pilots in, and the community-based organization we would try to pilot. So we have been, I'd say, on the road. We have limited resources to go on the road. As Scott mentioned, we went to the Commission Officers Association of the U.S. Public Health Service in May, and there were three counselors there from Fort Hood who heard the presentation. I have some friends in the public health service as well, and they were receptive to it. They saw some things that need to be addressed and thought about, and that's perfectly fine. But nobody said this is a non-starter. They all said it is a starter. So we're trying to build that now. We would like to go back to the Commission Office of Corps, and then maybe the military health command, and also talk with them about this project. We've spoken with others who have been giving us great counsel, and the word is, look, you have to have your community-based organizations, you have to have your funding, you have to have your work plan, and then you can bring it up to, I guess the appropriate term is the brass, and get them to endorse it. Unless you have all of that, they're not going to take a good look at it. So your comment is right on. We're trying to build that consensus. We've not done this before. We don't know how to do it, quite frankly, so we're taking the best shot at it we can. And you're the perfect audience to try and help us.
Just add one quick thing. And one of the things that comes up that is going to be a little bit difficult to get complete buy-in or to get buy-in from the people who would actually be served is some competitiveness between the military services, thinking that we're stepping on their toes, or the perception, if you're going to something that's under the auspices of the U.S. Army, you're not anonymous anymore, or you think you're not anonymous anymore. Part of the purpose of what we're trying to do is make this a completely off-the-books kind of a thing, that if you need the help, you can come get it, and your CO is not going to know about it. And so that, I think it would be a perception issue, and that's something that we have to deal with, to figure out how do you, because it would be nice to have the funding from the Department of Defense, but it would also nice be have to have that funding, but without their name on it, which is very the odds.
Yes.
And the children, it's the parents, the grandparents, the siblings who are all impacted, and I
The two questions I have, one is that I've been doing a lot of work with veterans who have separated from the military, and the struggle between leaving military culture and reintegrating into civilian culture, and trying to find meaning in life and find meaningful work. And I'm wondering if you are doing any sort of outreach to those who are separated, or primarily focused on those who are skilled, active duty, reserve, and National Guard. And then the other question is, you mentioned that you're training community-based counselors, and I'm wondering if there's going to be an element of military culture to make sure that they're culturally competent to work with veterans.
Yeah, those are very good points. We certainly don't want to forget about the star moms and dads out there. And certainly my wife would beat me over the head with a wet linguine if I even thought of that. But also, when we say families, we do recognize the extended families, all the variations and flavors of families coming these days, the loved ones, the support network. We're trying to keep the verbiage simple and relative, but absolutely you're correct. And, yeah, conceptually, we do recognize that part of the training must be cultural competence. Core principle in any health literacy is understanding the cultural competence of the target audience, and that certainly is no different here than anywhere else. Have we worked with individuals separated? I know Scott's done a lot of work in the veteran. I'll let him and maybe Armin address that, and Jennifer. I have.
Yeah, our work, just to answer your question, and I want to echo Sal's responses in terms of honoring what you're saying in terms of support network. You're absolutely right, and I will think more about the words that I'm using in talking about military servicemen and women and their families. I'm always thinking in my head the range, but thank you for raising that sensitivity. You're spot on. We, in this work that we're doing around comprehensive soldier fitness with DOD, we're working with the military men and women who are in their service time. So not really with those who are separated.
And to answer the second part of your question there in terms of the competence piece, is I think, to be honest, is the reliance from me, but also for our organization, on the veteran service organizations themselves and the four-year relationship that we've had, whether it's been through the Time Out for Veterans Health initiative that we've done, or the Veterans Health Council work that we've done. So my hope is to really draw from their expertise, and you know, we don't know it all, and really rely upon their expertise.
I've heard some horror stories about people who've been referred out of the VA to community-based organizations for counseling and having to train their counselors in order to get them to health services.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. I like this whole concept, and I think the sort of charitable foundation funding mixed with DOD. Have you a congressional advocate that you have in mind, or because I think it's got to be the basis involved also with you know, the services buy-in with health affairs. It sounds like a drop in the bucket compared to what we're spending just gobs and gobs of money on.
We've had some soft dealers
with programs already that are on base, you know, with military counselors or with contract mental health providers and other, you know, family services already. And I think to have another option to people, with, you have to have kind of a good sales pitch. But it would seem like it would be easy to get a congressional ad to say, go do it if the DOD is reluctant to put in some seed startup money, if you will, and see if it works enough to have it part of the appropriation.
We have made some soft feelers out to members of Congress. It was prior to the November elections. I think we'll let things calm down a little bit, reassess who might be interested and who's chairing what committees and that sort of thing. I think there is now a golden opportunity, because I can't imagine a member of Congress not being willing to help champion this kind of a very important trial activity. So you're absolutely right. We're trying that, and hopefully we'll be very successful.
Yes.
In 2009, there was a Department of Defense instruction that came out saying that civility operations are to be given equal weight as combat operations, and the military is going to be doing a lot more humanitarian assistance in the upcoming years, and that's my particular area of interest. So I was just wondering, is there any conversation at any level that you've heard of targeting our veterans who have been on humanitarian missions for some of the very unique mental health impacts that result from those missions? We all talk about combat veterans. Mm-hmm. What about those from Haiti? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or that took place on a MedCat mission and saw... Exactly. I mean, when I was in grad school, one of our classmates knew a Navy girl who had just gotten back from Haiti and said she hated Haitians because she felt like they stole her humanity. So we have veterans being, you know, very deeply impacted by what they're seeing on humanitarian missions, but because it's not combat,
yeah, I think that's perfectly appropriate. We've struggled with wording. We've used hostile zones. We could use foreign zones, or we could use one or two words and then give explanations. I think the intent is not to, and certainly my son has not been to a combat zone, but he has, he has told me about stories that, you know, difficult for him. So as we flesh it out, that's wonderful feedback. It's not to exclude, for sure. So we are looking for the correct words.
I think in some abstract sort of way it's being dealt with, because if you look at the statistics on suicide, for example, something like 60% are combat veterans. And so sort of begs the question of what about the other 40%? And certainly the people you're talking about, the humanitarian folks and even people who are guarding an embassy, who are gone for a year, where they may not see anything at all, but you still have issues to deal with as far as coming back home, because it's not only the post-traumatic stress issues, it's the things I was talking about before, when you're walking into a house where you think nobody loves you anymore, but that can be pretty traumatic in a different sort of way, and we need to be looking at that as well.
Yes. Yes, in the back.
I'm an airman in
I'm just from DOD, so I'm just a little wondering, is there going to be resistance to it? And second, in Minnesota, we have something called Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, and it's a governor's initiative. I don't know if you've checked into it or not, but it's very similar to what this is, and communities within the state are being adopted as Yellow Ribbon communities that are offering a lot of what you're suggesting. So BTYR.org tells...
What is it again?
BTYR.org.
B as in boy?
Beyond the Yellow Ribbon.org.
B, thank you.
Otherwise,
yeah. We suspect that there are lots of incubators out there and lots of projects that are there, and that's more than helpful to help make the case, because one of the things you always have to do is proof of concept. In terms of money and funding, yeah, I think Armin said it, you know, everybody's protective. All I can say is no one has a lock on the solution yet. There are lots of incubators and no one has a lock, and I think trying another approach. And not everything will work for everybody. Not everyone will like to go to a community health center. Some people will want to go to a coffee house. Some people might want to go to another type of venue. People in the military, like the population in general, have lots of different predilections. And paramount importance to this is has to be a comfortable, natural environment for them to go to. So if there's any successes in looking what you've done in North Carolina or Milwaukee or in your community, yeah, let a thousand, you know, lights bloom, whatever that saying used to be.
Your point about Military One Source is an interesting one, though. I did a CD for them and a webinar and wrote a bunch of articles for the site, but I think they do wonderful work, but they don't always play nice with everybody else, and which is... It's unfortunate because there are so many great organizations and they tend to be very covetous of their space. And you know, so it's something that we're gonna have to work around.
Yeah.
I just like to reflect back to what people were saying, and that is I agree that there's always seems to be some institutional resistance, but also within the institution you find people, goodwill, that look for ways
Yep.
get this kind of project bring it to fruition. So in Wisconsin, so they've been able to bootstrap it, and actually two others have been able to. But it's, you know, it's it, and yes, they've bumped up against some of these other places, but they've also found a way to be successful in it.
Yes, in the front.
My name is Ben Neufeld. I live in Los Angeles. I'm with the medical care section, which has a committee on veterans' health. My question is, what about women?
Women, we're looking at active duty, and certainly hopefully we portray the notion that this is stresses a gender less, you know, stressor. Women are under stress, so certainly women military members and women who are affected by the deployments are certainly within our plan to engage them either as military personnel or as the at-home family. Absolutely. And young girls? Absolutely.
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
There's a... Everybody knows there's primary prevention, so resiliency training for the global soldier fitness assessment that's in place now and is being implemented. That's primary prevention, which would avoid having suffering the sequelae of stress and trauma. Things you're talking about are secondary or tertiary prevention, which is treating the illness after it occurs, or dealing with the sequelae of those various illnesses. So we're, you know, dealing with different things, but because it's such a large population, diverse group, trying different modalities is very important, because we have different components. We have cross-leveling in the components between active active reserve guard. We have many soldiers who are active who will deploy with another unit, so they will have the same adverse consequences, as you mentioned, for reservists or civilians, because they will come back to the community they didn't deploy with. It's a very complicated issue. But for the primary convention, which falls to the DOD, 2006, suicide came on the radar, and these stress issues came on the radar, and they implemented very aggressive programs, mandatory training based on the best information available on public health against suicide, and made people more responsive to interventions. They started fielding teams that went around all around Iraq, around Afghanistan, interviewing soldiers to try and identify, get smarter about this. That was the military health, mental health assessment teams. They did four iterations of that way back. And a large amount of resources and very great attention was paid to the issue of suicide. And then the rate went up, and it was all ratcheted up again. And so, context, the situation objectively is not that the callous, evil government ignored the dedicated citizen soldiers. This has been aggressively addressed, and it hasn't worked.
Scott mentioned this in his presentation that I think is a very key thing, which is about 75 or 80% of veterans don't access the VA. VA is probably set up better than anybody else to deal with post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury. They get it. But you know, you've got all this huge number of people who are just not going there. And it's not the greatest analogy, but it kind of reminded me of the civilian groups that were buying flak jackets for the veterans, because they just weren't being provided what they're supposed to be provided, but they weren't being, and so somebody has to step in and do it. It's not quite there, but you know what I'm saying.
Let me, I'm not an epidemiologist. Lord knows my professors who tried to teach me epidemiology would be just second to a grade. But there is a phenomenon when you're looking for something, you find it. So I think maybe embedded in all of this is the military has recognized it. They've done a marvelous job of doing what they can do within the environment that they operate. So I, in no way, do any of us who are proposing this idea disparage what they're doing. We're just suggesting an alternate augmentive path. When you go out and you want to buy a red car, all of a sudden you didn't realize all the red cars are on the road until you want to go buy a red car. Maybe it's the same sort of thing with this, that you could suggest that maybe it did work and the rates would have been significantly higher, or there was a more concerted effort to identify individuals at stress and more individuals were coming forward, so the numbers will go up. But I think that's all successful. I don't know that any of the statistics that I've read in prior years, I don't know anybody who's done or published on those and said, we believe these are hard and fast numbers. I think that they believe everything I've read, if I'm remembering correctly, says, well, we think this understates the problem. So maybe what we're seeing here is that the problem is being a little bit more appropriately stated.
You know, just throw one more thing in there. We've been talking about suicide. Suicide is part of the deal. We're not talking about all of the people who are getting into car accidents or getting drunk and doing, you know, having violent episodes. There's a lot of injuries that are happening out there too that we aren't even talking about. I mean, so I think it's important that, I'm glad you said something about that, because we need to be broadening a little bit. Suicide is absolutely something you need to deal with. There's really no going back from there, but the people who have resorted to something that hasn't quite killed them or somebody else, it also warrants discussion.
Well, I think that's... I think that's about all the time we have for today, but thank you all for attending, and I'm sure